perfectly, and what its texture should be when it has been cooked gently and properly. We can and do train for all that, but training for emotional skills is next to impossible. We aim to hire people who possess an emotional skill that Chef Michael Romano calls the excellence reflex. People duck as a natural reflex when something's hurled at them. Similarly, the excellence reflex is a natural reaction to fix something that isn't right, or to improve something that could be better. The excellence reflex is rooted in instinct and upbringing, and then constantly honed through awareness, caring, and practice. The overarching concern to do the right thing well is something we can't train for. Either it's there or it isn't. So we do need to train how to hire for it. We don't believe in pursuing the so-called 110% employee. That's about as realistic as working to achieve the 26-hour day. We are hoping to develop 100% employees whose skills are divided 51-49 between emotional hospitality and technical excellence. As I've mentioned, we refer to these employees as 51%ers. I want the kind of people on my team who naturally radiate warmth, friendliness, happiness, and kindness. It feels genuinely good to be around them. There's an upbeat feeling, a twinkle in the eye, a dazzling sparkle from within. I want to employ people I'd otherwise choose to spend time with outside work. Many people spend a large percentage of their waking hours at work. From a selfish standpoint alone, if that's your choice, it pays to surround yourself with compelling human beings from whom you can learn and with whom you can be challenged to grow. We also look for intelligence in hiring staff. We're thinking about open-minded people with a keen curiosity to learn. Do they ask me questions during interviews? Do they display a broad knowledge about a lot of subjects or a deep knowledge about any one subject? A hallmark of our business model is to continually be improving. So I need to stock our team with people who naturally crave learning and who want to evolve. People who figure out how each new day can bring rich opportunities to do something even better. Striving for excellence, as we do every day, requires curious people who also take an active interest in what their teammates do. I appreciate it when waiters want to learn more about cooking. I love it when cooks want to learn more about wine. And I adore it when hosts and reservationists want to learn more about the person behind the name they're greeting on the phone or at the front door. A strong work ethic is also an indispensable emotional skill for any employee who's going to contribute to the excellence of our business. We want people on our team who are highly motivated, confident, and wired to do the job well. It's not hard to teach anyone the proper way to set a beautiful table. What's impossible to teach is how to care deeply about setting the table beautifully. When I walk into any one of our restaurants as its dining room is being set up for service, one of the most lovely sights to me is a waiter lifting a wine glass off the table, holding it up to the light, and checking for smudges. This is not because I'm an unreformed smudge freak, but because someone is showing care for a small detail, smaller even than what the average guest may notice. When an employee does not work out, the problem more often stems from an attitude of, I won't, rather than, I can't. A high degree of empathy is crucial in delivering enlightened hospitality. Empathy is not just an awareness of what others are experiencing. It's being aware of, being sensitive to, and caring about how one's own behavior affects others. We want waiters, for example, who can approach a new table of guests and intuitively sense their needs and agenda. Have they come, for example, to celebrate or to conduct business? Are they here to experience the cuisine or simply to connect with a colleague over a light meal? Do they want extra attention from the restaurant, or would they prefer to be left alone? Guests may think they're dining out to be nourished, but I've always believed that an even more primary need of diners is to feel nurtured. The most direct and effective way to let our guests know that we're on their side has always been to field a team that exudes an infectious kind of empathy. No business can truly offer hospitality if the preponderance of its team members lack empathy. But when each member of the team goes to bat for the others, the mutual trust and respect engendered among them creates an infectious environment of caring for our guests. The qualities of self-awareness and integrity go hand in hand. It takes integrity to be self-aware and to hold oneself accountable for doing the right thing. I want to work with people who have a handle on what makes themselves tick, Self-awareness is understanding your moods and how they affect you and others. In a sense, it's a personal weather report. Is the mood dry or humid? Is it rainy or stormy? Is it warm and sunny? Chilly, cloudy? The staff members' individual and collective moods influence the customer's moods. And in the intricate, fast-paced dance between the kitchen, dining room, and guests during a meal, when hundreds of people are being served, it's crucial for my staff members to be aware of and accountable for their own personal weather reports. No one can possibly be upbeat and happy all the time, but personal mastery depends that team members be aware of their moods and keep them in check. If a staff member is having personal trouble and wakes up angry, nervous, depressed, or anxious, he or she needs to recognize and deal with the mood. It does not serve anyone's purposes to project that mindset into the work environment or onto one's colleagues. We call that skunking. A skunk may spray a predator when it feels threatened, but everyone else within 2 miles has to smell the spray, and these others may assume that the skunk actually had it in for them. It's not productive to work with a skunk, and it's not enjoyable to be served by one either. In a business that depends on the harmony of an ensemble, a skunk's scent is toxic. It may seem implicit in the philosophy of enlightened hospitality that the employee is constantly setting aside personal needs and selflessly taking care of others. But the real secret of its success is to hire people to whom caring for others is, in fact, a selfish act. I call these people hospitalitarians. A special type of personality thrives on providing hospitality, and it's crucial to our success that we can attract people who possess it. Their source of energy is rarely depleted. In fact, the more opportunities hospitalitarians have to care for other people, the better they feel. Our ability to remain as good as we have been has always depended on our ability to attract great people. To the degree that we can do this, a virtuous cycle of hiring spins on. Sustaining peak performance helps us to attract other highly talented people, who in turn help keep our performance at a peak. Earning high rankings from critical sources such as the New York Times or the Zagat Survey not only increases business, it also improves our chance of fielding better and better teams. These teams further perpetuate our excellence and polish our public image. But I always caution against complacency. I instruct our managers to recruit new staff blood as if we're behind. In fact, we'll even create a job that wouldn't otherwise exist when we meet someone we just know belongs on our team. In addition to instituting an athletic hiring strategy, it's critical to be a champion at retaining top staff members. Business owner can too easily squander the winning edge that comes from fielding a great team by not treating its members with respect and trust, teaching them new skills, or offering clear challenges. Part of what I'm doing when I make my rounds visiting our restaurants is tuning into my team to feel, see, and hear what's truly going on. I'm watching to gauge their approach to their work, and I want to see 49% technical prowess, and I want to feel 51% emotional mastery. The ability to derive enjoyment from the pursuit of excellence is the best way to measure the team's 51-49 ratio, and it allows me to feel assured that we're doing our job as well as we can. A good sense of humor about oneself, one's business, and life in general goes a long way towards fostering good feelings to accompany excellent performance. Somehow in our society, a mindset took hold many years ago whereby the only way for a restaurant, or any business for that matter, to be taken seriously was to act serious. But if you go to many fancy restaurants, you'll sense that something's missing. There's a facade of refinement. Guests are leaning forward while speaking in hushed tones. Tuxedoed servers are calling a woman Madame and a man Monsieur, when everyone knows they're both American. Everything is delivered perfectly, cleared perfectly, decanted perfectly, and yet it's not fun. It's not sincere. There's no soul. It's a perfectly executed but imperfect experience. I encourage my staff to express and reveal their humanness, learn from their mistakes, lighten up, and relax. This is a contribution to the dialogue on hospitality that we work at quite consciously. But it too requires the optimal 51-49 mix. The idea is to attain a balance, hiring people who are naturally upbeat and genuine, but who are also high-level achievers capable of delivering excellence. We make it clear to our employees that we're going to give them a great troop of positive, hopeful colleagues to work with, with whom they can feel mutual respect and trust, and with whom they will be asked to achieve lofty goals. We're not a constellation of individual star employees. That idea would work against my core belief that hospitality is a team sport. Ever since my first experience as a boss, when I worked for John Anderson's presidential campaign in 1980, I've continued to view people who work for me as volunteers. It isn't that they've agreed to work without pay. I'm aware that you're all here on the most basic level to pay the rent, I will tell a new hire. Just as you need a job, I need people to take orders accurately and cook wonderful food. Then I remind them that if they're as talented at what they do as we believe they are, they could have gotten a job at any of 200 other very good restaurants for the same pay. You could all be doing what you do anywhere else, I say, but you chose to be with us. You have volunteered to be on our team, and we owe it to you to provide you with much more than just a paycheck in return. We want you to feel certain that you've made a wise choice in joining our company. It's a chance to work at a company where respect and trust are mutual between management and workers, where you can enjoy working alongside and learning from excellent colleagues, and where you can know that your contributions can make every day truly matter. Meeting with all our new hires, as I continue to do once every 4 weeks, often makes me think of the way champagne houses make non-vintage or multi-vintage champagne. All the major houses strive to produce a very good non-vintage champagne that tastes virtually the same every single year. They know exactly what the taste profile is and how to achieve it. They also know that the grapes vary from year to year. Each vintage produces grapes with varying degrees of acid, alcohol, or fruit, and so they keep aside wine from previous vintages so that in successive years, winemakers can blend together various vintages until all the elements balance perfectly and they've achieved the same consistent flavor they had the year before. That's called house style. Building our team is not unlike creating non-vintage champagne. Hundreds of employees have worked at our restaurants over the course of many years, and yet our guests, like expert wine tasters, should be able to identify a sense of continuity in the way they feel and experience our dining rooms. This continuity is based on our own carefully selected blend of the most caring, intelligent, and talented people in the hospitality business. That's our house style. Three hallmarks of effective leadership are to provide a clear vision for your business so that your employees know where you're taking them. You've also got to hold people accountable for consistent standards of excellence, and you need to communicate a well-defined set of cultural priorities and non-negotiable values. Beyond those, true leaders also need to hold themselves accountable for conducting business in the same manner in which they've asked their team to perform. I struggled mightily with the emotional and technical skills required for that kind of leadership as a 27-year-old first-time leader of my own company. As Union Square Cafe grew up, I realized that I too would have to develop new skills just to keep pace with my own restaurant and its staff. During one of his uncannily well-timed impromptu visits to Union Square Cafe when I was still in my 20s, Pat Setta sat down at a table with me and indulged my need to fret about the travails of managing my staff. I bemoaned the fact that I was failing to get any kind of consistent message across to my staff members regarding standards of excellence. Waiters and managers, at least half of whom were older than I, were continually testing me and pushing the limits, and this was driving me crazy. "If you choose to get upset about this, you're missing the boat, Lova," Pat said with reassuring calm in his indelible New York accent. Then he gave me a demonstration that has become integral to the way I view management. Pat Setta's simple lesson has helped me navigate through years of challenging moments as I've worked to encourage our team to build and sustain standards of excellence, especially while we're growing. Pat pointed to the set table next to us. "First," he said, "I want you to take everything off that table except for the salt shaker. Go ahead, get rid of the plates, the silverware, the napkins, even the pepper mill. I just want you to leave the salt shaker by itself right in the middle." I did as he said, and he asked, "Where's the salt shaker now?" "Right where you told me, in the center of the table." "Are you sure that's where you want it?" I looked closely. The shaker was actually about a quarter of an inch off center. "Go ahead, put it where you really want it," he said. I moved it very slightly to what looked to be smack dab in the center. As soon as I removed my hand, Pat pushed the salt shaker 3 inches off center. "Now put it back where you want it," he said. I returned it to dead center. This time he moved the shaker another 6 inches off center, again asking, "Now where do you want it?" I slid it back. Then he explained his point. "Listen, lova, your staff and your guests are always moving your salt shaker off center. That's their job. It's the job of life. It's the law of entropy. Until you understand that, you're going to get pissed off every time someone moves the salt shaker off center. It's not your job to get upset. You just need to understand that's what they do. Your job is just to move the salt shaker back each time and let them know exactly what you stand for. Let them know what excellence looks like to you. And if you're ever willing to let them decide where the center is, then I want you to give them the keys to the store. Just give away the fucking restaurant. Wherever your center lies, know it, name it, stick to it, and believe in it. Everyone who works with you will know what matters to you and will respect and appreciate your unwavering values. Your inner beliefs about business will guide you through the tough times. It's good to be open to fresh approaches to solving problems, but when you cede your core values to someone else, then it's time to quit. The center point of the table, Pat was saying, represented my core of excellence. Every other point on the table was, to some degree, a measure of mediocrity or even failure. But his powerful lesson also taught me to preserve my own energy and not waste it getting upset about a basic ongoing fact of life. Shit happens, lova. Understanding the salt shaker theory has helped me develop and teach a managerial style I call constant gentle pressure. It's the way I return the salt shaker to the center each time life moves it. A restaurant is like a stage for a modern dance ensemble, designed with props and animated by an intricate choreography from the front podium through the dining room into the kitchen and then back to the dining room again. Doesn't take much to move our salt shaker off center. All it takes is for one guest to be late, having taken longer than expected to send that last email from the office or to kiss the kids goodnight or finally get a taxi in the rain or cold. One party's tardiness may cause us to be as much as 20 minutes behind for the next reservation. If two or more tables are running late, we may end up with a pile-up at the front door, causing our standards to appear less than excellent. Our job is to adjust to circumstances and keep the dance flowing with technical precision and artful grace. It's my job, and consequently the job of every other leader in my company, to teach everyone who works for us to distinguish center from off-center and always to set things right. I send my managers an unequivocal message. I'm going to be extremely specific as to where every component on that tabletop belongs. I anticipate that outside forces, including you, will always conspire to change the table setting. Every time that happens, I'm going to move everything right back to the way it should be. And so should you. That's the constant aspect. I'll never recenter the salt shaker in a way that denies you your dignity. That's the gentle aspect. But standards are standards, and I'm constantly watching every table and pushing back on every salt shaker that's moved because excellent performance is paramount. That's the pressure. Constant gentle pressure is my preferred technique for leadership, guidance, and coaching. It's the job of any business owner to be very clear as to the company's non-negotiable core values. They're the riverbanks that help guide us as we refine and improve on performance and excellence. A lack of riverbanks creates estuaries and cloudy waters that are confusing to navigate. I want a crystal clear, swiftly flowing stream. Riverbanks need not hinder creativity, and in fact, I leave plenty of room between the riverbanks for individual expression and personal style. Every business needs a core strategy to be what I call always on the improve, and for us, it's constant gentle pressure. The name for this management style came to me from another restaurateur who was using it to describe his view of our company. I was in Aspen for one of my annual summer appearances as a speaker at the Food and Wine Classic. My partner at Union Square Cafe, Paul Bowles Bevan, and I had returned to town following an appearance on Good Morning America at the crack of dawn, and we dropped into the Ajax Tavern in search of a cup of coffee. We got to talking with Michael Chiarello, who was then the chef and one of the owners, and who was holding court at the bar. This was in June 1998, a few months before we were to double the size of our company by launching 11 Madison Park in Tabla, and we were looking for all the strategic advice we could get. Michael was in a growth mode himself, with restaurants in California and Colorado, and a big idea for a mail-order company to be called Napa Style. We asked him a lot of questions about how he managed his time with so many businesses to run, how he delegated, and to whom. After sharing a number of valuable insights, he said, "There are some things I could learn from you guys as well." "Like what?" I asked. "Well, the word on the street is that you've got the single best management style of any restaurant company." "It's nice of you to say that," I said, "but what do you mean?" "I'd call it constant gentle pressure," Michael said. And then he described precisely what we had been doing. That morning was the first time I ever stopped to really think about this important aspect of my own business style, which so far had been intuitive. Michael Chiarello had given us a great gift by providing language that would allow us to share and teach a business philosophy. It helped me to understand that we needed all three words, constant, gentle, pressure, working at once to push our business forward. This is one aspect of life where batting .667 isn't a winning average. Leave any one element out, and management is far less effective. If you're constantly gentle but fail to apply pressure when needed, your business won't grow or improve. Your team will lack the drive and passion for excellence. If you exert gentle pressure but not constantly, both your staff and your guests will get a mixed message depending on what day it is and probably won't believe that excellence truly matters to you. If you exert constant pressure that isn't gentle, employees may burn out, quit, or lose their graciousness, and you'll probably cease to attract good employees. Leaders must identify which of the three elements, constant, gentle, or pressure, plays to their greatest natural strengths, and, when necessary, they must compensate for their natural weaknesses. In the bi-monthly training sessions that I conduct with all our new managers, most of whom have just recently taken on the big new responsibility of becoming someone else's boss, I stress how fundamentally different their new job is from their old one. As line employees, like cooks, waiters, or hosts, their first concern was to achieve win-win transactions for our guests. As managers, their primary job is to help make other people on our team successful. I urge them to use their position to maximize the positive impact they can have on and for our team. By what they embody and the spirit in which they embody it, good managers can have a multiplier effect and add significantly to the company's excellence. Poor managers have the power to do just the opposite. The moment people become managers for the first time, it will be as if the following three things have happened. First, an imaginary megaphone has been stitched to their lips so that everything they say can now be heard by 20 times more people than before. Second, the other staff members have been provided with a pair of binoculars, which they keep trained on the new managers at all times, guaranteeing that everything a manager does will be watched and seen by more people than ever. And third, the new managers have received the gift of fire, a kind of power that must be used responsibly, appropriately, and consistently. The imaginary megaphone is to let our managers know that we place so much value on what comes out of their mouths that we want to make sure everyone hears it. The binoculars are to convey that we expect each of our employees as well as our guests to watch them as they exemplify the values and goals of our restaurants. The megaphone and the binoculars place a weighty responsibility on the shoulders of managers. What they say and embody matters and will be heard, seen, and scrutinized by all. If we were a copy machine, managers would be the documents we would want to replicate. We're very careful about which documents we feed into that machine. Fire is the most important element in management's application of constant gentle pressure. During my early inexperienced years as a boss when I first got into business, it was far more important for me to please people and be liked than to be respected. By abandoning my fire, our excellence suffered. The biggest mistake managers can make is neglecting to set high standards and hold others accountable. This denies employees the chance to learn and excel. Employees don't want to be told, "Let me make your life easier by enabling you not to learn and not to achieve anything new." I'm a bottom-up manager who subscribes to the concept of servant leadership, as articulated by the late Robert Greenleaf. He believed that organizations are at their most effective when leaders encourage collaboration, trust, foresight, listening, and empowerment. In any hierarchy, it's clear that the ultimate boss, in my case me, holds the most power. But a wonderful thing happens when you flip the traditional organizational chart upside down so that it looks like a V with the boss on the bottom. My job is to serve and support the next layer above me so that the people on that layer can then serve and support the next layer above them, and so on. Ultimately, our cooks, servers, coat checkers, dishwashers, hosts are then in the best possible position to serve our guests. A balanced combination of uncompromising standards and confidence-building reassurance sends a very clear and consistent message to your team: I believe in you, and I want you to win as much as I want to win. You cannot have a dynamic organization unless you are constantly encouraging people to improve and believing that they can do it. For years, I didn't believe that power was a positive force or anything to strive for. I grew up in the 1960s and 70s when many young people saw businesses about taking, not about creating value for the world as you profited. When I first went into business in 1985, I was determined not to display power overtly. I thought I could be a business owner and a manager without using my own fire. I was entirely wrong, and for years I unwittingly sent mixed messages, befriending staff members rather than leading them. So now I tell new managers, fire is power. We are giving you the gift of this fire. Use it responsibly, appropriately, and consistently. People need it, want it, crave it, and expect it. Use your fire wisely, and you will become the greatest leader your team ever had. Use it abusively, and you will lose your fire. Don't be afraid to lead and to teach. As it does in cooking, fire adds heat, clarifies, and distills the ideas that drive your business to solid results. Most managerial problems stem from an irresponsible, inappropriate, or inconsistent use of fire. It takes time to learn, but until managers understand all the different ways they can and must use their fire, depending on the circumstances, they cannot reach their own greatest potential or help others reach theirs. Managers can use their fire as a torch, a light for guidance and teaching, for leading and showing the way. They can use their fire to offer warmth and empathy, to make employees feel safe. A manager's fire can be used as a campfire to form collegial bonds with employees and to inspire others and help them grow. A fire can be used as a bonfire to rally the troops, to foster team folklore, to get the group motivated, and to bring people together for a unified pursuit of a common goal. Managers who inspire high levels of performance in their employees know how to produce magical results that leave people in awe. Managers must be wizards. The way they breathe fire is a source of motivation that impels employees to imitate them and to grow. And managers must learn to use the fire in their own bellies as a way to fuel and refuel their own ongoing passion for this business. If leaders lack fire, why would anyone want to follow them? When managers use their fire improperly, employees will always figure out ways to snuff it out. If a manager builds too many campfires, suspending his or her own power and authority by spending too much time relating to certain employees as close friends, power may be compromised, causing the line between manager-employee to dissolve. And others may resent feeling left out. Even the most compassionate manager must sometimes use fire to singe or scorch someone who's dishonest or disrespectful to a teammate, a guest, the community, a supplier, or the restaurant itself. An organization puts itself in grave danger when it permits integrity to be compromised. The development and training of managers and the articulation of a cohesive and consistent management model are crucial for any company, especially a company that is experiencing rapid growth. With each year I've spent as a leader, I've grown more and more convinced that my team, any team, thirsts for someone with authority and power to tell them consistently where they're going, how they're doing, and how they could do their job even better. And all the team asks is that the same rules apply to everyone. By 2004, as we prepared to open the complex of dining operations for the Museum of Modern Art, MoMA, that now together serve up to 2,000 people each day, I realized that we had been making an error that left us ill-prepared for success. However well we had hired and trained line employees, we had done only a middling job of developing managers who had the requisite skills to open and operate a high-volume, high-level restaurant. There wasn't enough depth on our team to transfer managers to the MoMA complex without also stripping away talent we needed at our existing restaurants. For me, this was a troubling slap-in-the-forehead moment. I asked myself, how could we have been in denial all this time? As our company grew virtually overnight from about 650 employees to over 1,000, we needed to focus even more intently on strengthening operating and accounting systems, human resources, and technology. It's delusional to think that the day-to-day performance of your business is anything other than a reflection of how motivated or unmotivated your managers make your line employees feel. It was suddenly imperative for us to give priority to the development, education, and coaching of our managers. This part of our infrastructure was all but non-existent. It was as if we had been basing my approach to readying managers on the tenuous assumption that anyone we hired as a manager already got it, knew the system, and could articulate and pass along the values and methods that define the company. Not only was I wrong, this sweeping assumption, just add water, was grossly unfair to the managers and the people they led. We were at a turning point. I have yet to find any skills more pivotal to success than effective recruiting and hiring. And the most important hires are the managers, who are themselves responsible for hiring and setting the tone for the business. Like it or not, it's their performance that represents the highest excellence and hospitality you can expect from your staff. At any given time, approximately 15% of our employees are managers. Since I believe that as our management team goes, so goes our staff, Paul Bowles Bevan and his human resources staff came up with certain specific traits that define the mindset and the character traits we look for when making a decision about hiring a manager. The first is an infectious attitude. Does this person have the type of attitude I would want to have spread around? Would I want my staff to be imbued with it? If the answer is yes, I continue on. Next is self-awareness. When I scan their resumes, I often tell management candidates that their career story is like an autobiography they've been writing for many years. You've made a lot of interesting choices, and I'm very curious about why a job with us strikes you as the next logical chapter in the book of your life. I also want to know why they feel they've finished the most recent chapter. Why does this particular twist in the plot make perfect sense to you right now? Candidates may convey a straightforward desire to move on to a better place. They may express resentment about the managers they've been working for. If a person shares details that are none of my business, that can reveal something about his or her discretion or lack thereof. Sometimes candidates indicate that they've simply maxed out on their present employer's career curve and are determined to make a wise next choice. I'm also quite interested in people who have shown enough enterprise and curiosity to have learned something about our restaurants. I'm most impressed when they apply what they know about themselves and about us to what they know they want for their career. Then there's charitable assumption. Enlightened hospitality is a philosophy that works best with optimistic, hopeful, open-minded people at the helm. It tends not to work when the leaders are skeptics who think they already have all the answers. Those people are a finished product in their own minds, and so is everyone else they work with. A charitable mindset assumes the best in other people. Mindsets tend to become self-fulfilling prophecies. When you assume that people's stumbles are honest mistakes that come from a good place, you get farther with them during their victories. When you assume the worst of people, you get the worst from people. It's important that our managers maintain a charitable assumption about the people with whom they work and about the guests we serve. Doing so even when a mistake has been made gives employees the chance to react with integrity and to be accountable for their actions. I expect our managers to have the same mindset with regard to our guests. I've been to many restaurants where management berates guests for being 20 minutes late for a reservation, when there may well have been a good reason for their tardiness. It's hard to justify being ungracious to anyone who wants to spend money at your restaurant. A charitable assumption might be, "You must have had a tough time getting here. We're delighted you made it. I'm going to get the most out of my relationship with every guest, including repeat business, when I base the relationship on optimism and trust." Hospitality is hopeful. It's confident, thoughtful, optimistic, generous, and open-hearted. We also look for a long-term view of success. If you have a philosophy that puts employees first, guests second, community third, suppliers fourth, and investors fifth, you implicitly have a long-term perspective, at least as long as your lease. We create restaurants for the long haul, and we make decisions based on that commitment. Every time I'm faced with a decision that involves an investment of money, I analyze the potential return by asking, will this yield today dollars, tomorrow dollars, or never dollars? Only the third alternative, never dollars, is unattractive to me. For example, if you come to one of our restaurants and the waiter accidentally breaks the cork on your bottle of wine, everyone's uncomfortable. The waiter's embarrassed, and you might be wondering if that means the wine itself was bad. At this point, I would want the waiter to be candid. I'm sorry I broke the cork. I assume the wine is still fine, but if for any reason it's not, just let me know and we'll gladly replace the bottle for you. If the wine is good, we'll get our today dollars. If it's not, we're still in the running for tomorrow dollars because we've established goodwill with our guest. This approach also gives the guest a stress-free opportunity to be right in the event that the wine turns out to be off, and it removes the onus on them to challenge us. Next, we look for a sense of abundance. One of the toughest disciplines in every business is to measure and predict cash flow, the volume of money available after all expenses have been paid. In very lean times, such as we've experienced during serious recessions or in the weeks and months following 9/11, effective managers and owners need to develop the ability to squeeze olive oil from a stone. In our restaurant culture, that tight-fisted approach can put the optimistic principles underlying our business style to the test. This approach makes it much more difficult to be generous to staff members, guests, and the community. In hard times, it can be enormously challenging to be generous with suppliers and next to impossible to be generous with investors. But counterintuitively, we've also learned that it is sometimes possible to recharge and stimulate the top line of a business by instilling a generous and confident sense of abundance. Just after September 11th, 2001, the revenue at each of our restaurants dropped precipitously. The number of guests reserving was also way down. For about 2 months following the attacks on the World Trade Center, the entire downtown restaurant and business sector suffered. Of our restaurants, Tabla suffered most and had the toughest time recovering. One reason was that Tabla, like 11 Madison Park, is housed on the ground floor of the investment bank Credit Suisse, whose own business suffered dramatically following 9/11 and whose bankers cut back on their business entertaining. A further reason was that Tabla, being associated with Indian culture, was unfortunately an object of the early backlash after 9/11. Some Americans were prejudiced against any person who looked like what ignorance and fear imagined a terrorist to be, or toward any business staffed by such people. Bangladeshi and Indian taxi drivers in New York were affected by this ill-informed wariness, and so was Tabla. We tried hard not to lay anyone off, but to make ends meet, we did have to shorten the hours many of our staff members were scheduled to work. We looked at the menu and asked ourselves whether we really needed to use expensive ingredients like lobster. Did we really need 12 entrees if 10 would save money by ending each night with less waste? We also analyzed the menu to see if it might be possible to eliminate a cook through attrition. The fewer menu items, the fewer hands we'd need. It occurred to me that starving our way out of this predicament might protect our business, but for me, playing defensively was an unnatural approach to the underlying problem of too few guests and too little revenue. I hated doing business that way. So, I made a decision that taught me a lasting business lesson. Rather than apply a sense of scarcity and uncertainty to Tabla, I applied a sense of abundance. Hand-wringing over low covers and low revenue is getting us nowhere. I truly believed that a sense of abundance would create more business. Though it made little apparent budgetary sense, we began participating in charity fundraisers and offering gift certificates for dinners at Tabla as auction prizes far more generously than even before. It was a very effective way to target our marketing to people who tended to care about our favorite causes and who also might take an interest in Tabla. If an occasional guest at Tabla happened to attend a charity fundraiser and noticed that we were a sponsor of the charity, he or she would probably feel a sense of affiliation with our restaurants. and anyone who would compete to make the highest bid on an auction item for our restaurants is a fan or a potential fan. By giving more, we'd end up getting more. If you want to be busy, especially in times of scarcity and uncertainty, you cannot accept diminished standards of excellence in even one area. You do everything you possibly can to show your staff and guests that you care deeply about improving. That's acting from a positive and hopeful place rather than from fear that can ultimately be self-fulfilling. The mindset of "we're just hanging on" perpetuates scarcity. Investing money, imagination, and hard work to create a mindset of abundance achieves abundance. Not long ago, we donated dinners for four at six of our restaurants to the Brady Center for Handgun Safety, which would auction off the dinners. The winning bid for the 24 dinners was $12,000. We helped a cause that mattered to us, created an opportunity for like-minded guests to affiliate with us, and effectively advertised all our restaurants to an ideal audience. And then there's trust. It's extremely difficult for a manager to motivate people if he or she tends not to trust others. Similarly, it's extremely difficult for employees to trust or want to follow the lead of a manager who doesn't trust them. It's hard to do your best for an extended period of time when your primary motivation is to avoid disapproval. We look for people who are naturally trusting. True, it's necessary for a manager to have a modicum of healthy cynicism in order to identify team members who act out of self-interest or who work the system to their advantage, but it's never useful to cause paranoia in everybody else by having a mindset of mistrust and fear. Most human beings are motivated far more by the desire to please other people than by the desire to stay out of trouble. Mistrust tends to breed more mistrust and ultimately dishonesty. If your bosses do not trust you to begin with, they unwittingly set up a game or a trap. The employee is challenged to figure out ways to beat the system. If I can't please you just by being good and honest, and I can't advance at work by performing admirably, I may as well play a game in which I can win by giving you what you're expecting from me, mistrust. Trust and mistrust are also mindsets that become self-fulfilling. Some bosses and managers rule by constantly threatening disapproval or, as is often worse, by giving no feedback whatsoever. Being non-responsive keeps employees on edge, off balance, feeling vulnerable and divided. For many insecure managers, that's the point. It's not an oversight, it's a strategy, or it's insecurity about confronting conflict. Either way, it's counterproductive. It will not sustain a healthy workplace. Our managers need to understand the dramatic distinction between fear-based and trust-based control. Analyzing this distinction helps us to sharpen the managerial skills needed to define excellence and failure in our model of enlightened hospitality. We also look for approving patience and tough love. Tough love is another term for frank, "I'm on your side" honesty by saying, "I care enough about you to tell you the truth, even if the truth is tough to hear." Patience with tough love sends a clear message to your staff that you're on their side. We also put a premium on outward and unequivocal messages of approval. It is absolutely incumbent upon managers to praise employees for good work. As I once read in Kenneth Blanchard's One Minute Manager, it's the manager's job to catch people in the act of doing things right. I subscribe to that, and I take it one step further. When managers catch somebody on their staff doing something right in a consistent or remarkable way, I encourage those managers to let me know about it so that I can learn, also so that I can then connect with employees and tell them that their boss told me what a great job they've been doing, with specifics. This allows the employees to feel seen and appreciated both by their boss and by me. It feels especially good and is a powerful motivator when your boss's boss catches you doing something right. Feeling seen and acknowledged is a powerful human need. Paul Bowles Bevan taught me that a traditional greeting among South Africans is "Ubuntu." It is not traditional there to salute people by saying, "Hi, how are you, what's new?" Ubuntu is an expression of humanness, which simply means, "I see you." That simply and effectively addresses the core human need to be seen and to feel seen. It's hard to imagine that it wouldn't also apply to an employee, a customer, or a manager of a company. The number one reason guests cite for wanting to return to a restaurant, or any business, is that when they go there, they feel seen and recognized. Imagine if our hosts consistently conveyed, "I see you." I'm fairly certain that's precisely what most people want. I also look for not feeling threatened by others. I would not want to follow a paranoid leader who is always looking over his shoulder, fearing that someone was trying to put out his or her fire. I'd want to follow a leader who is secure, firmly in control of that fire to illuminate the way for me, to keep me enlightened, teach me, keep me warm, motivated, awed, and inspired. Under those circumstances, I'd be delighted to follow my leader and occasionally even lead my leader. But I would certainly not be at my best as an employee if I were constantly enabling my leader's insecurities. Show me a defensive boss, and I'll show you a team desperate for new leadership. Great bosses own up to their mistakes, insist on learning from them, thank others for pointing them out, and move on. And then there's character. For our managers to become great leaders, we identify and assess a number of crucial character traits that are a subset of the 5 core emotional skills: optimistic warmth, intelligence, work ethic, empathy, integrity, and self-awareness that make a 51%er. Those traits include honor, discipline, consistency, clear communication, courage, wisdom, compassion, flexibility, the ability to love and be loved, humility, confidence, both to possess it and to inspire it in team members, passion for the work and for excellence, and a positive self-image. These traits may mean something slightly different to different people, but in the aggregate, they are the ideal characteristics of a highly effective leader, no matter what business he or she is in. You cannot be a great leader unless a critical mass of people are attracted to wanting to follow your lead. Overall, integrity and self-awareness are the most important core emotional skills for managers. You must be self-aware enough to know what makes you tick. You have to understand your own strengths, weaknesses, blind spots. You need to surround yourself with a team of people who will mirror your integrity, but complement and compensate for your strengths and weaknesses. That's critical. There's absolutely an art to surrounding yourself with great advisors and effective auxiliary sets of eyes and ears. These are the leaders on whom you must rely to present you with timely, accurate, balanced information and to apply constant gentle pressure on your team so that you can move your company decisively forward. A leader can be charismatic and lack integrity. A leader can be charismatic and have no compassion or empathy. A great leader must repeatedly ask himself or herself this tough question: why would anyone want to be led by me? And there had better be a good number of compelling reasons. I believe that leadership is not measured just by what you've accomplished, but rather by how people you depend on feel in the process of accomplishing all those things. Frequently, the people who tend to get tripped up in our company at higher levels have a tough time plugging into how other people feel. It's not that they don't care about others, they just lack a strong natural sense of empathy. We do the best we can to coach them and to show them where they are missing the boat. Some are able to rise to this challenge, and many aren't. The air grows increasingly thin the higher up the ranks of leadership a manager moves. The more powerful people become in an organization, the more emotionally intelligent their management skills must become. We've had many, many people who have succeeded as dining room managers and even in the next position up, such as assistant general manager, but they've subsequently fallen short as general managers, and we've had to part ways. This has also been true of some cooks who became sous chefs and ultimately executive sous chefs, the rank just below chef. Many excellent cooks have become sous chefs after technical cooking prowess won them the respect of their staff. But when they next became executive sous chefs, their emotional skills were no longer adequate for this higher level of authority and power, and the staff withdrew its support, making it clear that we should do the same. For some reason, when certain people gain more authority and power, they tend to demand respect from those who work for them. But what got them their promotion in the first place was their natural ability to command respect. Demanding respect creates tension that can make it very tough to lead and very uncomfortable to follow. Strong technical skills are usually the reason most people get their first or second promotion. But the higher you climb the ladder of power, the less technical skills count, and the more significant emotional skills become. Employees are expert boss watchers who instinctively focus their binoculars on the bosses with the most power. If they see weaknesses in character traits and ideals, they can and often do strive to put out the boss's fire in a hurry. Sometimes we have terminated managers not because I decided unilaterally to fire them, but because over time the staff came to a collective decision that they were lacking in some of these character ideals. Managers have a power over employees that creates a distinct imbalance in their relationship, and that power must be consistently and fairly imposed for the good of the restaurant and the way we do business. And team members are fully entitled to hold management to even higher standards, especially in a company that embraces for itself the same character ideals that it demands of others. This becomes a virtuous cycle. People who get promotions should earn them not just because they're ambitious, but primarily because they embody the company's character traits in abundance. And since they're willing to do everything it takes to perpetuate those ideals, we function as a hospitalitocracy, with the entire team reciprocally bound by the same underlying culture of enlightened hospitality. As human beings, we're all fallible. You've got to welcome the inevitability of mistakes if you want to succeed in the restaurant business or in any business. It's critical for us to accept and embrace our ongoing mistakes as opportunities to learn, grow, and profit. Baseball's top hitters can make 7 mistakes out of every 10 at-bats and still ride a .300 lifetime batting average into the Hall of Fame. We also need to expect the unexpected. We never know in advance if the next pitch will sail up and in or down and away. Will it be a fastball, a forkball, a knuckleball? For us, the secret of the game is anticipating mistakes, harnessing them, and addressing them in constructive ways so that we end up in a better spot than if we had never made them in the first place. The style with which a company addresses mistakes can define its heart, soul, and success. In our restaurants, we've experienced all kinds of mistakes, mishaps, and adversity. Once a large dried floral arrangement caught fire in the dining room with flames shooting 10 feet high. We've survived electrical failures and flooding. We've called EMS units after guests have passed out in the middle of the dining room. We've seen a mouse run across a guest's white tablecloth and a beetle turn up in someone's salad. Back when we permitted smoking, a 2-inch cigar ash was actually flicked from the upstairs balcony down into someone's bowl of risotto at Union Square Cafe. A drunk man took his pants down and mooned our guests through the outside window of our front dining room. We've sent out our share of garments for quick dry cleaning when servers have accidentally spilled soup or drizzled olive oil on designer scarves hanging over the backs of chairs. But the worst mistake is not to figure out some way to end up in a better place after having made a mistake. We call that writing a great last chapter. Whatever mistake happened, happened, and the person on the receiving end will naturally want to tell anyone who's interested all about it. That's to be expected. While we can't erase what happened, we do have the power to write one last episode so that at least the story ends the way we want. If we write a great one, we will earn a comeback victory with the guest. Also, the guest will have no choice but to focus on how well we responded to the mistake when telling anyone we made it. We can then turn a mistake into something positive. To be effective, the last chapter must be written imaginatively, graciously, generously, and sincerely. And sometimes, we even write a great last chapter when it was the guest, not us, who made the mistake. If someone spills his or her glass of wine at the bar, we pour another round, period. A child once spilled a glass of Sprite at his table, so we bought all 6 members of his family a round of what they were drinking. If a guest doesn't like his or her dish, even if it was prepared the right way, it's to be removed from their bill. I have found that when you acknowledge a mistake and genuinely express your regret at having made it, guests will almost always give you a chance to earn back their favor. Take, for example, a mistake as simple as a dropped plate of food. If a waiter who's heading for a table of six accidentally drops a plate on the way there, five people in the party will have hot food, but a sixth guest will be left with nothing to eat. Do we make all six people wait? Do we leave one person feeling awkward while the other five eat? We deliver the five ready dishes, and checking to see what the sixth guest has already eaten, we come up with a quick and complimentary mid-course, a small soup or a salad for him or her to enjoy while we remake and replate the missing dish. Unless something truly grave has occurred, like food poisoning or someone slipping in a pool of olive oil, it's sometimes helpful, when appropriate, to actually inject a little humor into the great last chapter. I was at 11 Madison Park during lunch one day when the former Senator Bob Kerrey of Nebraska, a regular at our restaurant since becoming president of the new school, came in for lunch. When he greeted me, he asked, "Did you hear what happened last night at Gramercy Tavern? We had a dinner party in your private dining room." I hadn't heard about it, and that embarrassed me.